Welcome back. This is the Coaches Rising podcast. Today, I'm joined by Paul Lawrence and Susie Skinner. This was really an exceptional conversation for me. We are going to be talking about The Wise Leader, which is a book that Paul and Susie brought out not too long ago. And it's a guide for thinking differently about leadership. So we're going to explore some of the common myths that are really prevalent about what leaders are and do, and actually bust those myths and explore instead, you know, how can we view leadership? And so I learned a lot in this conversation. There's some really powerful distinctions, really hopeful distinctions. And we get right into some of the themes are themes that have been quite common over the last year or two on the podcast. You know, the invitation into our relationality, how the relationship between things is more primary than the things themselves, to quote Ian McGilchrist. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And just to say a few more things about Susie and Paul. So Susie is Managing Director of Roar People, that's R-O-A-R, a boutique consultancy in Sydney, Australia. She's working internationally. She's an MCC, the author of Build Your Leader Identity, as well as The Wise Leader. Her work's been published in several peer-reviewed academic journals. Paul is the founder of Leading Systemically. I recommend the other podcast that I've done with Paul on team coaching last year. He's been working in the field of leadership, coaching, and change for more than 20 years. With over 5,000 coaching hours experience, he's trained at Oxford University. He's the publisher of several books. He's also a team coach, and he's built the Team Leader Instruction Manual, which we talked about in our previous podcast. So that all being said, let's dive right in. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. So Paul and Susie, it's great to have you with us. How are each of you doing, first of all? Yeah.
Very well. Lovely to be here, Joel. Excited about today.
Yeah. And I'm doing very well as well. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. So we're going to get into this topic of wise leadership, and you wrote a book on this topic. And actually, I find it, I love how these conversations, because they offer important distinctions that can open up new possibilities for us. So maybe the first question could be, what had you write this book? How come you came together to write this book? And maybe before we even define what wise leadership is, we could contrast it with, you know, what are some of the common ways we view leadership right now that maybe are out of date? Mm-hmm. I'll let either of you pick that one up.
Okay. Good. So how did it come about? I think that there's two questions there, and I think they relate to each other because we've both worked in this field for a long time, probably at least 20 years each, just as consultants, coaches, and we both worked in businesses before where obviously leadership was a big issue, and we went to leadership programs and so on. And we both, I think, at the same similar time, just got to a place where we kind of were shaking our heads a bit and saying the current narrative around leadership isn't really doing it. And because it's often, you get this dichotomy between leaders have got to be very clever and task, able to manage tasks, and leaders have got to be very able to bring people on the journey, and they've got to be able to do the emotional bit. And of course they do. But when you think about it, just look at some of the characters and the leaders in the kind of public domain. There are some folks out there who are very clever and are quite empathetic, who are still struggling big time with some of the complexities that we face. And you see that at a micro level within organizations. So we were looking for that. There's something missing here. And where we chose to go looking was the literature around wisdom. That's a bit harder than it sounds, because the literature around wisdom is a bit esoteric. It doesn't necessarily lend itself to practical application. So that was the task, and that took us a good couple of years to go through, not all the wisdom literature, because the wisdom literature is enormous, but to go through some of the wisdom literature and kind of come up with a bit of a thematic analysis about what that might look like. And then in terms of how Susie and I came together to do it, certainly my thinking around it, what came out of was these five areas, which we'll talk about later, one of which was this commitment to learning and this commitment to reflection. And of all the five areas, that was the one I didn't actually feel I had an awful lot terribly interesting or original to say. And of course, Susie's just finished her PhD on, I know it wasn't about this, but the big learning for me around it was how do really effective leaders reflect versus not so effective leaders? And I think that was kind of our coming together point. Suze, what would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I think we were both, 24 years for me in the industry and sitting at conferences and listening to this focus on skills and competencies, and yet, having walked away from, a session or a team session and being blown away by the level of complexity, right? The issues that clients are bringing to the table, and just feeling a mismatch, right? How are we equipping ourselves? How are we equipping other coaches to really handle the complexity that's coming our way? So it felt like a really important lens, Joel. And one of the things Paul and I talk about is we don't claim that our book is the only pathway to wisdom, right? I mean, there's, hundreds of years, thousands of years of wisdom out there. But what we try to do is sort of distill it in such a way that coaches and leaders can find it accessible, can just give them another lens. Like, one of the things we've talked about is that leaders, and I use coaches, leaders interchangeably, right? Coaches are leaders, leaders are coaches. But they're looking, they're hungry for a new perspective. They're hungry for a new way of being able to kind of get their heads around what they face every day. And so, Paul's sort of work in the wisdom space and my focus on reflection felt like a lovely coming together of perhaps a way to offer that to folks that might be helpful.
Yeah, beautiful. I find this fascinating, because this is a conversation we're having right now about what is the role of coaches in these times. And I think it's a generalization, but we could say one of the aims of coaches has been to help people become successful, to be successful in different areas of their life, whether that's leadership or other things. And I think wisdom is actually what's being really invited in these times. Like, we expand just being successful to include wisdom, where do we go to become wise? And John Vervaeke's posed that question, like, we know where to get knowledge and information, but where do we go to become wise? So I'm just curious what you think about the role of coaches around helping people become wise versus like how it's commonly held.
So interesting. So for me, and I've just, as I mentioned, I was just in your beautiful city last week, talking to a team of leaders around this very topic. And, you know, Paul probably has a slightly different slant on this, but for me, it's about permission around the beingness, right? Who are we being in that space? Who are we being as coaches? Who are we being as leaders? And so the wisdom dialogue, I think, gives us permission, gives us what, you know, avenues to really bring that humanity forward. Because if you think about, you know, what leaders are still struggling with or still sort of grappling with is that connection piece, whether it's the hybrid work or the, you know, the level of pressure in the system that organizations are sort of bringing to bear. So I think there's a humanity piece here, Joel, and I think it's about, you know, what we've tried to do in the book is try to distill some simple principles, right? They feel simple, but the doing of them, right, is such a conscious effort. Things like, you know, as Paul said at the beginning, things like reflection is actually a muscle that every human on the planet has, right? It's not part of your character. It's not something that we have to kind of measure per se, but it's a muscle you're already exercising. But our question is, how are you exercising that muscle? And how do you do it in ways that actually lean towards more insight, more wisdom? So, you know, I think it's things that are already sort of human capacity that we're just kind of amplifying. Yeah. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think what I'm about to say is probably in line with that. It's just this different articulation of it, but how do we help people become wise? And where a lot of organizations will straight go to in their heads is, well, we need a course to help people become wiser. Whereas what we do know, I think what we all know just through looking at even the cursory examination of the wisdom literature, it'll talk about experience, and it'll talk about that experience and how you become wiser through experience. And we would challenge that, because we all know plenty of not terribly wise people. We just, however you define it, we just intuitively know people who are not wise, who are older than us. And actually you bump across some rather young people who seem incredibly wise. So it's not just about experience, and it's about the reflection on that experience. And that's why the reflection piece sits right at the heart of those five mantras. You know, you've got reflection in the middle and all the rest of it around the outside, because that commitment to reflection is one way of thinking about the key to it all. And that's consistent with, I like the work of Ralph Stacey, who's really very dismissive of this notion of trying to define leadership in terms of skills and competencies, and talks about practical judgment. And he emphasizes again the role of experience and reflection in terms of becoming more adept at practical judgment. And I think of that as the same as wisdom. That the last thing I'd say is that in the model, as we'll probably explore later on, we have built in some of these ideas around adult development. And it just reminds me of Uni of Sydney did some work on, I'm sort of closing the loop here, but did some work on adult development a few years back. And their experiment was to test people's levels of adult development before and after going to a course. And guess what? There was no difference. So it really is at the heart of the model is the reflection piece, and helping people to learn to reflect differently. And that's just one way of looking at it.
So I can feel the impulse to ask about reflection, and I'm going to do that in a moment. But actually, first, I want to ask you about, and this might actually segue into reflection. What is the worldview shift like that's occurring, or, you know, what is the kind of higher level shift in the way we should view leadership? If you could articulate that, because we've already said, you know, that competencies often it's reduced to a simplistic set of competencies which are fixed and decontextualized, and that's a mismatch with the complex world we're in. So, like, could you just articulate a little bit, like, how that worldview shift we could make that would contextualize the rest of the conversation around reflection and some of the other elements?
Do you want to go, Susan? Do you want me to go?
You can go first because I know we have slightly different views on this, Joel. So that's
I
good.
love that, by the way.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
To me, as I'm thinking about that question, I think of the self-transcendent piece of the five mantras, and I also think of the Think Metta piece because they're both quite similar, and in it, or they're both related. When we talk about self-transcendence, that's where we have this connection with the adult development piece, because it's about a way of thinking. It's about a way of thinking where, of course, I'm still in the moment and I'm having conversations and I'm being triggered by my emotions, but at the same time, I'm kind of got an umbrella view of myself in relation with somebody else. And I'm hyper aware that we've both got different experiences, different backgrounds, and therefore different ways of looking at the world. And those two aspects of myself kind of work together in cahoots, but it's a different way of thinking. You might get it intellectually, that doesn't mean you actually think that way in the moment. And that connects into the Think Metta piece, which is where we talk about five different ways of thinking about change. And one way of thinking about change is I get to pull all these levers and control outcomes, right? That might be successful some of the time. It's not going to be successful all of the time. When we sort of move along the range of these five ways of thinking, that the other way of thinking is a very self-transcendent way of thinking, where I don't think of change as levers to pull. It's not the way I look at the world. I don't think in terms of hierarchy. I don't think in terms of cause and effect. I don't think necessarily in terms of organizations and teams with solid boundaries. I just see the world in which I'm operating as a bunch of people having a conversation. And my role as leader is to be able to engage in that conversation in an effective way, which means I really need to be listening differently, voicing differently, and all of that requires thinking differently.
And worldview, I mean, I love all of that. I agree with all of that. Worldview came out very strongly in my PhD. But to answer your question about that shift, that sort of meta shift around the thinking, for me, it's also, so Paul talks about the ways in which we enable change, which is really practical, right? How do I think about change? How do I bring that to life? What sits underneath that is an embodiment, I believe, around just this uber interconnectedness, right? Leadership is a social process. Leadership is about people. Leadership is about positive influence. And so, what sits at the heart of wisdom is being really other focused. That even from a reflective point of view, a lot of the leaders that I interviewed in my research would say things like, you know, Susie, I don't tend to reflect about myself. I tend to reflect about others, what we need, what the collective needs, because it's a recognition that we're just not independent. We are absolutely dependent. And there's a growth mindset. It sort of almost takes growth mindset a step further, right? Which says, I don't just recognize my ability to learn and grow and fail fast and all those, you know, really good principles, but I also recognize that I actually only grow through the people around me. I grow through others and they grow through me. And so what that brings is this worldview around humility, right? This kind of incredible humbleness that I can only lead and grow through you, and I want you to lead and grow through me. And I think that that is a really powerful shift for leaders, as Paul said, not to just make, you know, intellectually in their heads, but to embody that in terms of how they show up.
Yeah, I totally agree. That is that piece around I see myself not apart from this broad social network. I see myself as in it, just the same as everybody else is in it. And that's how the world operates. That's how change operates. That's how it all operates.
Yeah, I feel really excited hearing this. There's been big themes on the podcast about, Ian McGilchrist's notion of how like the relationship between things is even more primary than the things themselves. And
Exactly.
that took me quite a while to get my head around, because it's quite profound actually to begin to open to that. And Dan Siegel talking about Mui, MWE, like that, challenging this atomized, hyper-individualistic sense of self that we've inherited, where we're somehow separate from the systems that we're part of. So, Yeah, really, really excited to hear this. Maybe it's a good point now to, to dive in. Maybe the first thing you could do is just like name these five elements. I know we've been naming them already, but so we can just clearly hear them, and then let's dive into the reflective learning and how you see that, in a way that cultivates wisdom. How can we do that? Yeah, and how do we currently tend to see that in a way that doesn't?
So the we're both very passionate about the reflective learning that sits at the heart of this. It's foundational, Joel, and as we said earlier, it's sort of a fundamental human practice anyway, right? It's literally, we're not asking people to kind of pick up a toolkit and do things differently. We're asking them to strengthen a capacity they already have and to channel it in ways that are constructive versus diminishing, right? So that's sort of at the heart. And then we move into what I like to call uber selves awareness, right? That self-awareness is good and it's a lifelong journey, but actually we are multiple selves. My first research was very much around leader identity as one identity of multiple identities we all carry. And so how do we as leaders recognize how multifaceted we are, that internal complexity that we bring to our leadership and welcome those selves in? Welcome themselves in, and really, one of the things Paul and I are passionate about is redefining authenticity, right? It's not about my one true self. The literature is just as broad that says there are multiple selves that we bring to the table, and the work is how do they work together? How do we consciously dial them up and down depending on the context that we find ourselves in? So selves awareness is the next one. And then we move to this idea that Paul mentioned earlier about then recognizing that and being able to transcend that, recognizing that when I'm in dialogue with you and Paul right now, actually there are multiple selves that all of us bring. How do I almost put myself down in service of the selves that the other person is bringing? And I think that again is a lifelong sort of muscle to build. And then we move into the think meta space that Paul had mentioned before. So how we think about change and much more of a systemic integrated view that coaches, no matter where they're operating, in organizations or any part of the world, are part of that system, that they are an active influencer within a system and don't sit separately to it. And then finally, a bit of what we're doing today is how do you bring that to life through dialogue? So really doing dialogue in a way that we are able to suspend all of our assumptions and noble certainties, and be present, be genuinely present, to what's in front of us. So really simple stuff, Joel.
Yeah. Another way that we sometimes talk about these five mantras, we call them mantras, is in terms of leadership myths. And that kind of gets attention. So the commitment to reflective learning piece, the myth there is all you need to do is to reflect more often. That's the myth. Because what we're talking about, or what one of Susie's expertise, her PhD research, was no, effective leaders don't just reflect more often, they reflect differently. The self-awareness piece, which Susie touched on, is the myth is that authenticity is that quest to understand your one true self. We actually think that's a counterproductive idea because of the multiplicity piece that Susie talked about. The self-transcendence piece, the myth there is around this individualistic leader as hero piece versus the interconnected piece. The change myth is that leaders get to control outcomes. And we're quite clear, you don't get to control outcomes as a leader. It's a scary idea, but you don't get to control outcomes. You do get to influence, and that takes us into that conversation. And the myth in the do dialogue piece is this piece about active listening, which drives me nuts when people talk about, yeah, I do active listening. There was a lady called Jo Tyler who explored that, and she found nearly a million hits on this phrase, active listening. And number one, they were all different definitions. And number two, as time went by, they became increasingly superficial and increasingly meaningless, really. So when people talk about active listening, it doesn't really mean very much. And so we talk about in much more depth about just how challenging dialogue is, and the ways, in different ways in which to listen, and the challenge of being able to voice without expressing judgment.
Nice. Yeah. Maybe we can move through them and weave together the picture of how we could inhabit each of these five domains. But how can we reflect differently? We start there. What is the way we can reflect?
The thing that comes up for me, and I again, I'm, you know, it's a recency effect, right? I'm thinking about the team I was with last week who are in operating in a really high performing but chaotic system, a system that's just under pressure. And so it's so interesting to shine a light on a practice that people are already doing and have leaders say, wow, I didn't realize reflection was a thing, you know, something that I need to pay attention to. But my research was really clear, Joel, that if you want to stand out, I love this saying, if you want to stand out in a chaotic system, you need to be able to stand still. And it talks to your point before, between, you know, about it's what's in between your ability to connect the dots as a leader, to actually take that perspective and really be able to bring greater insight. So, very quickly, my research, I partnered with a tech company in Silicon Valley. I had 150 leaders around the world sort of opt into the research. And I was really interested in what are the you know, confident leaders doing differently to the less confident leaders, as Paul said earlier. And, you know, for several years, so self-efficacy, leadership efficacy is one of our most researched sort of domains in the leadership literature. We know it's about experience. It's about give them a coach, give them a role model, give them a stretch assignment, help them manage mood effectively. All those things build self-belief, which is fundamentally a driver for performance. So the aha moment for me, I literally almost fell off my chair, was, you know, having immersed myself in the field for about 18 months and interviewed leaders at every level of this organization. So early in career, not just the ones with the title, not just the ones with experience. And it came down to this reflective process, this common reflective process that they were all engaging in, that they had all through their own life experiences learned and then consciously channeled. And so those, as Paul said, what it looks like is three fundamental differences. So one is the worldview piece you talked about earlier, absolute commitment to an abundance worldview, to being the voice of possibility in the room, to really looking at what we might be missing, what's available here in this challenge, right? As things are falling down around them, they will be the voice of possibility. And what sits underneath this is an absolute commitment to a belief that people are way more capable than they often see in themselves, right? So that wonderful sort of belief that they share with others. And then the second one was what I called, so one is choosing positivity, actively, effortfully choosing to see the world through that lens. And of course, we've got the last 20 years of positive psychology that backs us up there, right? That's a useful and constructive way to be orienting to the universe. And then, as I said earlier, this, it was coupled with this idea of symbiotic growth, that my growth is absolutely dependent on the people around me and vice versa, that we grow with and through others. And what's beautiful about that, just from a purely practical point of view, is that these leaders are in these discussions, meetings, high stakes sort of situations, and they're actively being the voice of what are we learning here? Here's let me share with you what I'm learning. They see every exchange, no matter the title, the position, the level of experience, every exchange is a learning opportunity, which I think is an incredibly powerful kind of frame to bring to leadership. And then the last piece was that those, you know, reflective positivity or this reflective learning process, as I came to call it, comes to life not through the, I mean, yes, through the Monday morning reflect before I go into my week, or Friday afternoon reflect on, you know, the before and after, what Donald Schoen talked about, you know, sort of reflecting on action. But really, this idea of reflecting in action, that it's the in the moment, those micro moments where we choose to be in that situation and orienting in our heads to what's going on here, what am I noticing around possibility, what am I noticing around learning, and also this beautiful thing, this temporal awareness around past, what have I learned in the past, what can I apply here in the present that takes us to the future of where we want to go. So absolutely dynamic, active, reflective practice. Does that make sense, Joel? Because I get very passionate about this.
I can feel that. And it makes absolute sense. And it's thrilling for me to hear because of, how much I resonate with this. But also, as you describe it, it really fits with that worldview we were just talking about, somebody that's like oriented towards a sense of possibility and emergence, and which is an active dynamic, impossible in any moment. And this symbiotic growth, this relationality, and then it happening in action again. So it's not like atomized, like I need to reflect afterwards, which I'm not saying is bad, but it's all happening in this like process, like relational field, which I find not only thrilling, but I imagine it's incredibly practical.
Exactly. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say the practical piece, because I was sharing some of these ideas with a group of coaches last week, and I don't have the same level of depth of understanding around Susie, but I think of this probably more simplistically. There's three ways in which effective leaders think differently to not so effective leaders, and they're very practical. One, the reflective process always ends with, "And what am I going to do next?" That's practical, and you can put that into practice as a coach by always. That you don't have to use the GROW model, but you're finishing with an intention. The conversation, the reflective process includes past, present, and future. That's something you can just listen for as a coach. And if there's something missing, you can ask the question. And the one that really, really, really woke me up is that the really effective leaders reflect with other people, not just by themselves. Because as a coach, I was encouraging people, you can reflect. You can reflect on the way home on the bus. You can reflect walking the dog. Of course, that misses. One of the key insights that Susie got from her research was the effective leaders, they reflect with others, not just by themselves. And that's a very practical point of inquiry for a coach.
I find I even think just yeah, so maybe I'm saying the same thing, but I recognized that a while back, and I had to work with a belief that I need to be intelligent. My intelligence comes through my own brilliance, like sitting there in my room, kind of like a genius. But what, and actually, in some weird ways, it does when I let go of the need to do that and it comes in. But what I realized was I think in partnership, all my greatest insights and revelations. And it's like you can feel the evolutionary process in relationship, And I think for me, that's interesting because these times where we're getting more and more polarized, and people maybe are disconnecting, feeling lonely. It's like the superpower of humanity. We're not tapping into that. And the reflection is that what I kind of get from what each of you are saying is that, there's a way that we can kind of go on automation or habituation. And actually what I'm hearing is like there's a dynamic participation in the relational flow of life. And that activates something incredibly powerful.
Exactly. And if you think about it again in that sort of situational awareness piece, it's recognizing that how you show up and the decisions you make, even what you verbalize in that moment, is actually your leadership in action. That is your leadership, right? And so if we're able to kind of help leaders and coaches just orient slightly differently, right? Orient, and it is effortful, as you said, but the outcomes are immediate, right? They're different because they're asking different questions of themselves and they're doing it through others. So, again, it's such an interesting thing to bring to busy leaders because the first thing busy leaders will say is, "Oh, I don't have time to reflect." And what we're shining a light on is actually, as you and I are talking now, coaching is a reflective process. You're reflecting already. My question is, do you know what quality reflection looks like? And are you able to really hold that view that says, okay, there I go again in the moment? I've gone to scarcity, I've gone to anxiety, I've gone to competition. And how do I, in technical terms, chuck a Yui is what we call it in Australia, right? Turn it around and orient to possibility, to how am I growing through the people, and what am I going to take in this micro moment of pausing that will completely shift this conversation and therefore the outcomes.
Maybe before we move on to like one of the other points, that brings up a question for me, which is how would you recommend that coaches can begin to work with this with their clients? Because in a way, I hear you saying like one of the things we might notice is where, of course, there's an educational piece. So yeah, that's there. But then like what I'm hearing is like our clients might be in that mindset of scarcity and yeah, maybe disconnection from others.
Exactly.
And so,
Isolation.
right. So we might reflect that to them, which could create self-awareness. But I'm just curious, how would you work? I mean, I know you, it's all very unique and dependent upon the situation. So it's kind of a challenging question, but yeah.
So again, I think Paul and I would orient to this slightly differently, which is the richness of our partnership, can I say? For me, I do think this is about a language. We live in language, Joel, right? So I do think as coaches, we can find ways to help clients take a balcony view, to notice their own mindset, to notice their own world view without judgment. Right, to be able to say to them, it's so interesting, Ed. What are you noticing about how you're orienting to this topic right now? Right, where what are you noticing around, scarcity versus abundance? Just kind of bringing that forward. And what I have always found fascinating, Joel, when we first started down this path, one of the things we do is we ask clients, even, to come. So we do a lot of this in team coaching, right? Because it's the operating system that sits beneath how I make decisions. It's a reflective process I'm engaging in that moment. So we ask clients to come to a session talking about where they reflect, who do they reflect with, and what for them is useful, sort of reflective practice. So straight away, you're normalizing the practice. And it's just always a beautiful thing because, leaders that have worked together for, years sort of look at each other and go, wow, I had no idea that that's how you orient to the world, and that there's opportunity for all of us to learn through each other. So you bring it to life in that session. And I think coaches can do exactly the same thing with clients one-on-one. Paul and I had a really insightful discussion with some clients in Finland only a few months ago, where we were talking about the fact that the way that the coach is reflecting influences the way that the client reflects. So it absolutely has to start with the coach challenging themselves around the ways in which we are almost, the neural pathways, we're almost channeled or programmed to go to scarcity, go to anxiety, go to what we're worried about, and forcing a just as valid view that says, what are the possibilities that lie within this?
Yeah, I'd love to hear your reflections, Paul. I'm just thinking of someone I know who said joy is a moral imperative in these times, and maybe a sense of attuning to possibility is also a moral imperative. So.
And just before I just say that, Joel, thank you. So some of the core elements of this choosing positivity is absolutely about joy and gratitude. That these leaders, again, under huge amounts of stress, are looking for the joy, are looking for that moment. And it's a micro moment, but we have them throughout our days, right? That is the joy of being human. But if we're not looking, we're never going to find them. So gratitude being a gateway to all of those positive emotions. I have teams of people that now ping each other and go, what sparked joy for you today? What was your moment of joy? And it's actually a useful stopping point to go, actually, thank you for that. It was this, this, and this, because you can always find it if you're looking for it.
Yeah, so I agree with all that, and I'd make, but I'd also make a broader point around this material, which is, I'd hate to think that coaches will read Wise Leader and only be looking to extract, oh, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. So that's a useful thing to do, and we talked about some practical applications of the reflection material. But for me, the big challenge, and this is the big challenge, is the recognition that I can only help someone become wiser through whatever lens I define that, if I myself am committed to becoming wiser. Because if I'm coming from a place where not just the reflection piece, but all of the material that we're going to talk about, if I'm committed myself to be learning from that. And if I myself am humble and I'm not kind of fearful of portraying myself as anything other than super wise, which none of us really are, if unless I'm humble and committed to my own learning, then I'm just going to be having intellectual conversations. The challenge for me is the wiser I can become, and you can define that word how you like, the wiser I will become, the more useful will my questions become. And I won't have to try. I won't need to look in the book of, you know, the book of wise questions. My questions will be wiser. They will be more useful the wiser I become. So my primary commitment must be to my own growth. Has to be.
Yeah, that's inspiring. And I might add, for me, what's been a major call over the years is a journey into in my own embodiment as a massive resource for accessing that kind of wisdom you're talking about there, Paul. So that I'm not just relying on my kind of intellectualism, conceptuality, but I'm able to kind of participate in the experiential intensity and unfolding of the moment, you know, which is rich with information and full of that relationality that we're talking about. So, love hearing this. Maybe we go on to some of the others, because this has been amazing so far. And so, you know, the second one, we talked about the myth of authenticity and the one true self. What's important to say about this one? And we've already touched into it a little bit.
This one for me let's start with the myth, because I think it's a really dangerous myth. Authenticity is that quest for the one true self. Now, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that we have this singularity of self. And let's not pretend that we totally understand the nature of self, but the evidence that there is suggests that our sense of self is distributed across the brain. And some people go, you what? But you just ask people, just think about it. How do you behave as a parent? How do you behave as a child? How do you behave as a friend? How do you behave when you're sitting with your direct reports? We show up differently in different scenarios. Of course we do. We adapt to those scenarios. So this, I remember doing a 360 a long time ago, and the person debriefing me said, look, you show up differently at home than you do at work. So you're obviously being inauthentic at work. What? I'm not. I'm adapting to it. And that's where it's a dangerous myth, because you will find people still saying, yeah, find that one true self, that one really good self, and push away all the other bits of you. That's where it's dangerous, because we define authenticity differently, and it's got two components to it. One, do you understand all those different aspects of self? And two, how well do those different aspects of self work together? And you're not going to make any progress on that if you're busy trying to push away parts of yourself. Most of us, I don't know what life would be like if we didn't have part of us that felt self-doubt. But we're often encouraged in the leadership narrative to push aside self-doubt, be brave, be courageous, where we would say, no, get to know self-doubt. Self-doubt is there because self-doubt cares about you and is looking to look after you. Self-doubt wants to make sure you don't take on the world and say yes to everything that you're asked to do. Self-doubt is there to say, when someone says, Paul, can you go and stand up and do a presentation in fluent Spanish to 500 people, that you go, I'm not sure I can do that. So it's about getting to know all those different parts of ourselves, but they need to work together well so that self-doubt doesn't show up and say, Paul, you don't want to stand in front of those 50 people and give a presentation on something that you know inside out. That's not helpful. That's when self-doubt needs to sit to one side. So that's where we're coming from. We're redefining authenticity, and we do it with great passion and enthusiasm, because we think this notion, this single self notion, is actually counterproductive and doesn't help. That's how I'd express it. What would you say, Suze? What would you add?
I agree. And again, in terms of bringing this to life, Joel, you know, you can imagine, you know, you're working with leadership teams who aren't steeped in the psychology and haven't read about multiplicity, are just living their lives. And you ask them, you know, take a moment to draw your different selves, right? You might sort of set it up a little bit, as Paul just did. And it, you know, back to joy, it's a joy because it just resonates. People go, yeah, there's my really driving self, there's my competitive self, there's my loving self, whatever labels they put on it. But it's a beautiful conversation that gives them permission to bring those selves and for them to recognize those selves in each other in a way that is embracing rather than punishing, right? In a way that kind of welcomes it in. Even if you think about 360 feedback, you know, the research around 350 feedback is that most of the time people walk away disempowered, disengaged, because they're being told not to do this and not to do that, versus a conversation that says, tell me how you're showing up, what parts of you are showing up with that executive team, what parts are going to be useful to show up in the future. And so, it, you know, it's that lovely, again, freedom that complexity exists within, but authenticity is to really know that complexity and work with it.
And to Susie's point, we don't have to go anywhere near multiplicity theory as a coach. One of the places I find it most useful is when a coachee is going, I don't know, part of me wants to do this and part of me wants to do that, and I can't decide. The multiplicity lens in my, this is what I mean about our own way of thinking goes, oh, okay, cool. Let's talk to this part of you and what that part of you wants. Okay, now let's talk to this part of you. What would this part of you want to say to that part of you? What would that part of you want to say to that part of you? And coaches often find that really, really helpful. And I don't have to go anywhere near talking about multiplicity theory.
Yeah. Yeah, what I'm hearing is that it can A, generate self-awareness in terms of parts that might be polarized or have different views, but also that clients could kind of consciously inhabit different parts. Mm. And that can bring skillful means. And that, you know, that what this is what I like about this as well is that it fits with what we've been talking about, that it's everything's contextualized. And that, you know, that kind of interconnectedness we talked about comes to mind, where in different environments, like different parts of me get activated and show up, and, you know, different kind of patterning, you know, of my leadership. And I'm just wondering what you would say about that, you know, that like your example, Paul, of like, you can help people notice this multiplicity of parts. What would we call the part of us if it's a part that becomes aware of the parts, you know, like a kind of meta awareness? Like, you know, I'm thinking of IFS, which I found incredibly powerful, where, you know, he calls that self energy, or that, like, self leadership with a capital S. I might call it presence. And yeah, I was just wondering. And it, just one last thing is, like, what I've found is that meta awareness allows me to develop skillful means, because it's like I can pick up different selves in different moments more easily, because I'm not just bound inside of these parts. Yeah.
Well, one of the lovely things about multiplicity theory is you get to choose your own theory. And Susan and I, there's two types, there's more than two, but there's at least two types of theory, and we each gravitate towards a slightly different one, because there are theories that say you have various terms for it, a narrator or an orchestrator, which is kind of orchestrating all the different cells. That there are theories that talk like that, and there's other theories that say no, what's happening is you just, one pops in, one pops out, one pops in, one pops out. And I'd say we both have probably a slightly different perspective on that, just through our lived experience, wouldn't you say, Suze?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely of the view, Joel, to your point, that there's a meta, there's a narrator, there's a, you know, that sort of coordinates all of this, but, you know, sometimes gets it wrong as well. Right. So, yeah. We've had, the other thing I think to point out is we've had people say to us, you know, there's a percentage of the population that actually don't identify with multiple selves at all. Right. That sort of sit there going, I have one, there's only one. And that's okay too, right? So let's talk about the one. So I think this is, to your point, I think it's emergent, and I think it's highly individualized, highly subjective.
Yeah.
But what's useful for the person, right? What's useful for them to think about themselves, is really what we want to kind of shine a light on.
My narrator is there sometimes, and sometimes it's just absent, and all the other selves are getting on with it. But that when I'm talking to some to a coachee, I'm not trying to impose my model on them. I'm seeking to help them make meaning of it. And Susie, what I really like, the point Susie made, I think it's about 5% of the population will just look at you blankly when you talk about this idea of multiple cells, multiple parts. But my experience is, if you stick them in a room of people who do get it, what you see is that kind of whole social nature of meaning making, and give it half an hour or so and they'll go, oh, okay, I'm starting to, you know, this is starting to make sense.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about some developmental theories that talk about the importance of a stage of development where one starts to become aware of like internal selves, you know, and that's actually a maturing. And you know, some of those theories talk about then developing into a kind of like home base being inside of a very subtle awareness. And I'm curious, like, you know, this is also like this like nice little segue question, but how does then transcend yourselves? How does, because know yourselves and then transcend yourselves? We talked about this a little bit, but what's this? What's the myth here again? And what's the opportunity?
Do you want to go, Susan?
No, go ahead, please.
For me, the self-transcend piece to your point, it's a lovely segue, because one of the key ideas in the self-transcend piece is who we are is formed by our relationships with others. And then you get family of origin stuff and nobody's terribly surprised, but who we are continues to be shaped by our relationships with others. So this takes us into the self-transcend piece, because it points to that interconnected piece. And this is an uncomfortable idea for some people, and it doesn't resonate with this individualistic idea of leadership. This idea that who I am is co-created with other people. But again, it just, when you look at life through that lens, it just makes sense. A lot of people that come to coaching are people who go, "What? I don't know what's wrong. I'm in this new organization and all these things I used to do, that they used to work, now they're not working." And there's a lovely insight on that, which says, yeah, the way things used to work in the old organization, because you were in a social setting where you'd all decided unwittingly that was a good way to behave. Now you're in a different social setting with a different set of people, and you haven't connected with those people. And what tends to happen is those people are very encouraged to adapt and change through the social interaction with others. So it's not just something that happened in our childhood. It's something that continues to happen, this notion of who we are is co-created with others. And that insight, not intellectual insight, but that just fundamental understanding and belief, gives us access to a whole different way of thinking about our relationships with others.
Particularly, one of the examples we love to talk about is when we're under stress, right? We call it the acid test. And someone has triggered us in different ways, or triggered parts of us in different ways. And where do we go? You know, where do we go in our heads? Do we go straight to defensiveness and frustration and anger, and I'm going to go right there? Or are we able to recognize in that nanosecond, right, there I go again, and actually I am going to just lean into curiosity. I'm going to be able to put those selves down, put all of that I might hold really dear, and actually lean into, okay, what's going on here for the other person as well as for me? And do we go to that place of curiosity? And honestly, Joel, I mean, I think if we're really honest with ourselves, sometimes we do and sometimes we definitely don't, right? Think about personal relationships, our romantic relationships, our family relationships. I think this is part of the muscle around transcending selves that is like a lifelong evolution.
Yeah, and we call it the acid test because you can explain this all to people and they're very clever and they go, yeah, I get it. The acid test is, what do you actually do, as Susie said, in that moment of pressure?
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I love this, because I think this is one of the invitations, you know, for all of us. And I start to hear how the other elements we've discussed already, like reflection in action, multiplicity of selves, start to come together as well inside of, just like, what is it like to be in relationship with others? I think this is such a, it's like we're getting into the transformational currency here, really, for me. Like, it's such a rich territory. And I see coaching schools and other modalities now emerging that really start to put attention on the experience of relationality in the moment, and being able to expand our capacity to be in relationship, and you know, and those moments when we get triggered, you know, and you know, which is again for me that the powerful practice there has been like, can I accept myself for being where I am, for being triggered, you know, and that is a kind of meta awareness.
Yeah, and you know, I love those, you know, sort of questions around who am I being right now and who do I want to be. Right? What parts of myself do I want to bring forward? And what parts of myself am I just going to dial down in this moment?
What do you think about the value, therefore, in this, you know, this transcending us yourself of the moving into the immediacy of the moment, in terms of, you know, sharing, revealing oneself? I know you've talked about it's really about forgetting oneself and being with the other and reflecting on them. But I'm curious about the potential to be in a kind of mutually transforming connection where one's, you know, I'm actually daring to reveal myself, like, oh, as you share that, this is what I'm noticing is here, and the other person might do the same, or this is what I'm noticing when I'm with you. You know, I might share something about the other person. What do you think about that kind of move into immediacy?
I love that because, it's probably a really important sort of clarification is that when we talk about sort of this reflective sort of muscle about people being other focused, it's not that they're not also, you know, they're doing the dual kind of who am I being in this moment, but what I meant by their other focus is that they're not getting into that sort of isolated, I must show up, I. It's a collective focus. It's who are we, which talks to your relationality, right? And I think that's right. I think, again, it's that ability to be able to self-disclose in the moment in a way that feels safe, but to just sort of try out, here's, you know, can we just take a moment? Here's what's going on for me right now. I'm really noticing that this is coming up. What's coming up for you? And what can we learn about that? It sounds really simple, but there's courage in that moment, right? There's courage to kind of stop the flow and take that perspective and then share. And again, that's why we talk about selves awareness. It's a much harder conversation to have, but so much more fruitful because it's honest. And it sort of shows, again, that complexity. It just talks to the piece that this stuff is not easy, right? I often get frustrated. I think there are just such incredible coaches on the planet and leaders. And when we talk about this, we start to get into an insight that this is hugely difficult. And so we're not always going to get it right either. But if we have that learning adaptation, that learning frame, and that willingness to self-disclose in the moment, I think we get closer. You know, we start to help one another navigate it.
The word that comes up for me is curiosity, and that's really what the acid test is about. Do I get defensive or do I get curious? If given what we just talked about on the cells awareness piece and the cells transcendence piece, if that's how I'm thinking, not how I'm a lovely idea, which I sometimes think about and sometimes don't. If that's how I see the world, then as I'm talking to you, Joel, I'm just super aware that there are multiple me's and therefore there are multiple you's, and all of these, my different selves and your different selves, come from somewhere and continue to evolve through discussion with each other and with discussion with somebody else. So as soon as I experience conflict, as soon as I experience this bumping up against each other, I'm not surprised and I'm not defensive. I'm curious, of course, because I'm going, wow, what's going on? There's all of Joel's cells, all of my cells, and there's some bumping up going, what's all that about? And I'm much more I'm much less likely to get defensive and have experienced all those emotions, and much more likely to get curious. And so my principal emotion in the immediate moment is curiosity.
Does this get us into the next piece around influence then? You know, I can see the natural kind of, you know, if you're curious in the moment, if you're in this relationality, that we're in this domain where we recognize, you know, maybe you can name the myth again, but we're getting into like how leadership can influence rather than control.
Please, Paul, I know this is your passion area. Go ahead. Don't hold back.
I've got lots of passion here. But I think we talked about this whole subject in a conversation a while ago, the systemic piece. And so we're not going to go through all that again. But just but the piece to me about this is, again, myths. The myth is that leaders get to control outcomes. And many of the change models that are still around implicitly, not explicitly, implicitly assume that leaders get to control outcomes. And the models tend to start with, I'm on the senior exec team and I can see what's going on here. I've got all the evidence together, and me and the kind of other senior leaders have worked out what the answer is, and it's logical and it's rational, and we thought it all through, and we need to communicate that to the rest of the organization. Communicate is one way. It's telling. And I used to work at a big multinational. They had a whole floor of people whose job, they were the communications team. Their job was to do pamphlets and videos and tell people what they needed to know. And of course, people then comply with it because we've already worked it out. And if they don't, they're resistant to change. And that's still so you still see that in organizations. It's almost the norm. Maybe I don't think I'm being cynical. It's a norm anyway. Whereas what we're saying is, when you compare people to systems, you've got to be really careful, because people are not compliant, they're not passive, they're thinking beings. And if I'm sitting there and I get an email from the leadership team telling me I've got to do XYZ because I don't go, oh yeah, oh yeah. I go, okay, what do I think about that? And I'll probably turn to the person sitting next to me, what do you think about that? And we'll make sense of that together. And over in another part of the organization, same thing going on, but it's different people making sense of it differently. And over there, other people, and they're making sense of it differently. And so these different perspectives emerge, and then they all sort of come together. And then the leadership team go, what are we hearing here? This is what we were expecting people to just get up. But there's all this stuff, and they keep asking us questions. And that's annoying. And it's annoying because I have an implicit script in my head that says, my job is to work out the answer, and your job is to go do it. And that doesn't work unless you're working in a very simplistic organization where the leadership team can follow everyone around and make sure what they're doing. So you don't get to control change, at which point a lot of leaders go, well, what's my job then? And you say, your job is to influence, and you do influence, by the way. You don't have to do anything new. You might not understand what you are influencing right now. Are you influencing the way that you want to influence? And if you really want to have influence, the first thing you're going to have to do is understand what's going on in your organization, which doesn't mean you go and ask three people and assume that what those three people think is what everyone else thinks. It means you've actually got to be looking for these coalitions, and you've got to be start hypothesizing around what's the process that's going on here in order to understand it and voice your view and voice your perspective. And but if you're going to voice your perspective, if you're doing this in an effective way, your perspective is open, because you're not really listening to what the organization's got to say unless you are actually open to be persuaded to maybe thinking a bit differently than you already are. That's what we mean by influence. And it's Susie was talking before about how hard all this stuff is. This is hard. Because you can't do this without being totally in control of your own emotions, which none of us are, unless you're totally aware of all the kind of things that are getting in the way of your listening, which none of us are, unless you never make a judgment in anything you say, which we all do. But we can get better at it. And I just come back to Susie's lovely reflection piece, which sits right at the heart of this model, because you only get better at it if you're willing to be open to the fact that you're not perfect at it now and engage in that ongoing reflective process. What would you add,
What,
Susie? Because you've got a different
well,
perspective.
no, I think what comes up for me is again, I'm thinking about the practical, what does this sound like? And the role of coaches or team coaches in particular is that when we hear senior teams talk about the resistance that's in the organization, that's it, right? Is it resistance? Is that about getting stuck in our own selves? Or are we able to transcend that and get really curious? So change initiatives have to be about, getting into dialogue, genuine dialogue with people, with that reflective learning. Every exchange is a learning opportunity. And then sharing, here's what we've learned. And based on what we've learned, here's what we, want to do with you differently. So I think that whenever you hear language around resistance to change, I think it's a signal of the work that still needs to be done.
Totally. Yeah.
What is a leader's role in terms of influencing? And what I mean is, you know, maybe we could just say like everybody's a leader, but just say there are, you know, there actually are like team leaders. And maybe this points to my own bias around my worldview. So that might actually be part of your answer, but I'm curious about influencing in terms of there's being in dialogue, there's listening, but is there more as well? Is a leader communicating the vision they hold, you know, the sense of mission? Yeah, like I'm just wondering what differentiates them from the other people in the team. Or maybe nothing does. Maybe not, maybe that's part of the fallacy of what I'm holding is in the question.
Well, I think it does, because what we haven't really talked about explicitly is the power dynamic that sits within organizations. And so power exists. We can talk about dialogue. If we don't talk about power, then the whole dialogue piece will start to sound a bit fanciful, because power dynamics exist. And positional authority, positional power is a form of power. If I have a lot more positional power than you do, then what I say has more is heard more, and it's heard differently. The reflection is, though, that positional power is not the only form of power. There are other forms of power. There's relational power. There's internal relationship power, external relationship power. There's resource power. There's other forms of power too. So, again, I think, yeah, people who are official team leaders, yeah, their view is different. Their perspective will be heard differently, but they're not the only ones. They're not the only ones whose views will be heard differently. So it's a little bit more layered than just thinking solely in terms of positional power.
I think it's both and, isn't it? I mean, we can sort of get stuck here, because you're right. I mean, part of the role of you know, organizations succeeding is having those frameworks around where are we headed, right? What is our purpose? What is our vision? All those things, I think, are really important. And perhaps maybe helpfully or not helpfully, I always think of that in terms of a management framework, right? That we're talking about leaders at every level. You're absolutely right. We want everyone to have a voice, to lean in, to have permission to bring all of their selves, or the selves they want to bring, right, to the table. And at the same time, we do want to kind of tease out that it's, you know, when there are, we all, that organizations are a management system that helps us get stuff done. So it's both end. How do we respect the managers that are more senior and kind of set that agenda, and at the same time lean into bringing that to life as leaders at every level? So I do think it's both end, Joel. Does that make sense?
To me, it comes back to the influence and control piece again. If I'm the CEO, I don't get to decide the vision of the company.
Yeah, that's right. It's co-created.
I can tell everybody what the vision of the company is. I'm allowed to do that, and nobody else is going to be allowed to have a town hall and tell everyone in the organization what the vision is. But what the CEO says the vision is, that doesn't mean that is the vision of the organization. If you want to understand the vision of the organization, you're going to go have to talk to everybody in the organization and ask them what's the vision of the company. And the official vision of the company is not necessarily, in fact, it's quite unlikely to be the same as the actual vision of the organization, which is going to be multifaceted. And the vision of the company in reality is consistently going to be changing as things keep happening in the environment and so on. So what the CEO is in effect doing is attempting to articulate something that makes sense to everyone. And some leaders will do that very well, and some leaders won't. And the leaders who do it well are the ones that are out there, who comes back to this theme we've been talking about all the way through. The leaders who are really connected, and understand their connectivity with the rest of the organization.
Who does get to decide the vision of the company? I mean, and in a way, I hear you saying it's emergent and it's multi-perspectival in terms of, yeah, the influences, and that it's not the CEO's job to maybe you know, go away in a room and like sit alone and craft it. But yeah, who does get to decide what the vision
depends
is?
How you define vision. If you mean What vision is everybody in your organization holding in their head and working towards? Nobody gets to control that. This comes back to control and influence. If you mean by vision, what do we get to put in the annual report this year? Well, that's the CEO. Mm. So it depends what you mean by vision.
Therefore, coming back to your point, and Susie, I'm curious what you think as well. But so in a way, we can, as coaches, we can support leaders, CEOs, to be tuning into that emergent vision, you know, by being in relationship both with people inside the company, customers outside the company, people, you know, other figures. And in a sense, the role we're playing is like attuning and articulating that attunement so that it stays alive and you know, doesn't kind of just become something written down and stale that gathers dust in a drawer.
Exactly. And I think that's the challenge, right? One of the key elements around the reflective learning piece that choosing positivity is recognizing that everyone in that organization has positive intent, right? What is that positive intent? Helping people articulate it, lean into it, share it with others. And then, you know, to your point around how does that then sort of corral the energy of the organization in a direction that everybody wants to go. I mean, it's an ongoing process. And I think the risk is, you know, as we've all been part of teams that sort of the senior team comes up with, this is what we're doing, and then they just present it. And that's where you get pushback, right? That's where you get the rest of the organization saying, I thought we were all leaders and I haven't had a say. So it has to be co-created, but it's going to look different based on what organization you're working with and the history, right? The history. And there's been a lot of damage done too, I think. I think people have felt, you know, back, you know, a lot of this work is unlearning those old hierarchical ways of being told and do as I say, often not as I do. We're really asking people to lean into the best parts of themselves, right? But to recognize the vulnerability that comes with that, because as Paul was saying earlier, it's just unrealistic to expect that the senior management team, as I like to call them, rather than the senior leadership team, won't get it wrong, because they will. We're all fallible.
When you say that, that's interesting. When you say, I like to call them senior management team rather than leader, can you say why?
Well, so some of the, and even the organization I partnered with in Silicon Valley, they made a, you know, if there's a fundamental philosophical belief that leadership is within everyone, and Paul and I share that belief, and Joel, I just heard you say it, right? Then we have to watch the language that we bring to that. It's not a senior leadership team if everyone's a leader. It's a senior management team that is sort of corralling the leaders within the organization. So I've had organizations change the titles of teams so that everyone is a leader in their job description, and it's just differentiated by the level of management that they're at. That's one example. And as you know, then there's the whole holacracy, right, where we've got team captains, and it's you know, there's no one straight answer, but I think we can get better in our language around validating the leadership that's within everyone.
Feels like it also honors that management is an important part of leadership. And I think
exactly.
That's often, you know, it's really emphasized that it's all about leadership, you know, but like management is happening. So as we come towards the end of our conversation, we haven't talked about dialogue, and maybe I think it's a good time just to tune into dialogue, and maybe just kind of, we've been doing this throughout the conversation, but in a sense, like the key invitations for coaches, coaching leaders, you know, like I think we have been doing that, but you know, what are the conclusions we're coming to here in terms of, yeah, well, how we can coach leaders as well. But I'd love to like weave in this dialogue piece as well. It feels like we've been, in a way, really talking about how do we have powerful dialogue, but I think there might be some more explicit things to say about it.
I think for me, one of the strategies we talk about is noble certainties, right? What are the assumptions that we bring basically to every interaction? And again, when you first talk to people about what their assumptions, what they hold true, people will often say things like, I don't really have any, right? But they're so prolific. We had a session with some coaches a couple of weeks ago. Do you remember, Paul? And we sort of, by the end of the session, we had pages of, these are, you're new to the organization. You don't know what goes on here. Really simple things that just sit under the surface that we all bring. Or as coaches, I see a leader, being quite toxic in their language, and then I'm going to get upset because I hold a noble certainty that people deserve respect, and so that they are everywhere. And so I think part of the challenge or the opportunity, more than anything, is back to that idea of suspending, right? Suspending. So we're back to self-awareness. What do we bring? And being able to suspend that in the moment, is one of the area ways that I would answer that, Joel. Yeah.
I think one of the things that we, for me, is just being really clear. It doesn't have to be our definition, but in an organization, people actually are clear about what they mean by dialogue. Because I often talk to folks about dialogue, and I can tell the person automatically thinks they know what I mean, but they're holding a different definition of the word. And we actually wrote a book called The Tao of Dialogue because we had that experience so many times. And by dialogue, and this is kind of just a bit of context to what Susie was talking about, we're talking about a very particular kind of a conversation. That doesn't mean other people can't define it differently. People will define things differently. But in terms of what we're trying to say, dialogue has a very particular meaning. And it is a form of conversation in which I am succeeding, as Susie said, in suspending all of my beliefs about what needs to happen next, my values, my non-negotiables. And Susie used the term noble certainties. It's the things, little voices in my head that are telling me, I already know the answer to this, or I know more about this than you do, or somebody shared with me their noble certainty yesterday. I did a session yesterday. Somebody came up to me afterwards and said, how do I manage this noble certainty that says everyone else is a moron? So we've all got these noble certainties. So how do we, and using Susie's language, suspend that. How do we suspend it? Not dump it, but suspend it so that we can truly go deeper in understanding where somebody else is coming from. So that's part of it. But dialogue is not just about listening. It just isn't just about listening. Again, people tend to focus on the listening piece. It is about voicing. It is about saying what needs to be said. It's not about telling other people what to think, but it's about saying what I feel needs to be said right now, and I'm going to express it, and I'm going to express it as what I feel, and I'm leaving space for what you feel. Okay, this is different from a leader whose primary purpose of going out and talking to the organization is to make sure they damn well know, blah, 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 blah. No, this is how what I'm thinking, this is what I'm seeing, and I want to know what you're thinking, and I want to know what you're thinking, feeling. And to do that effectively, I have to leave room for the other person's perspective. And that ain't going to happen if I'm expressing judgment. That just closes people down. So I have to be aware of that judgment. It's the same kind of idea as the noble certainties piece. That's dialogue. And that's how we're defining dialogue. And that's not easy. If you think that's easy, and I get people going, yeah, dialogue, it's not easy. It's impossible. Pure dialogue is impossible because it would imply you're completely self-aware. You're completely able to suspend your judgments, beliefs, and values, and you're completely aware to keep your judgments to yourself. Well, you only know you can't unless you know what judgments you're making and unless you really understand yourself 100%, and none of us do. So dialogue is an aspiration.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe that's the standard we can hold, is that we recognize that we are not perfectly self-aware, and that through dialogue we can actually, coming back to the original point around reflection, we can grow together in symbiosis, and that's one of the incredibly powerful things about dialogue. So if we hold that as a kind of principle, then we're imperfectly perfect in our practice, you know. And what I'm hearing is like what you said there, Paul, is like we people get closed down if you come with like rather than owning your experience, if you come in with judgment. And again, that speaks to me of the relationality piece is like, you know, people close down, there's a reification. It's like, I know what experience is. That's everything about that's taken me into this kind of more fixed kind of experience. Whereas what I hear is like, we're moving into something that's relational and fluid. And through participating together, we discover together and insights and possibility become possible. So, yeah, that's a really beautiful perspective.
I love what you just said, Joel. I'm writing it down, right? Participating together, we discover together. I mean, that's at the essence of this whole thing, isn't it? Right? That willingness to really recognize, particularly today, none of us have the answers, but collectively, we can learn and grow together towards some of those answers.
Yeah. I mean, this feels like a beautiful place to come to a close. I don't know if each of you would like to share like a closing comment, just anything, you know, in a sense, Paul, what you just said, like, what is there anything that might need to be said or that you feel called to express in this kind of closing comment?
For me, I'm just reflecting on the conversation we've had, and what I've just noticed is what's come out very strongly is this which you've been clear about, and Susie really was very explicit about early in the conversation, which is this whole relational piece. We are relational, whether we want to be relational or not. We are relational, and the other two words that have come up for me are humility and curiosity.
For me, I just think about the infinite possibilities that sit in that moment of delay, that pause that we take in dialogue with someone, where we get to actually do the sense check around where we might have automatically gone to and where might be more helpful, right? So I'm very passionate about that reflection whilst leading. I think if we could create more reflective teams and cultures of reflection, I think that that would go a long way towards sort of shoring up some of the anxiety that sits within the systems that we're working within. So for me, it's all about those micro moments, John. What about for you? What comes up for you?
Well, I just feel this is the massive opportunity really that exists right in front of us or right inside of us or with us, which is like turning towards this relationality as a kind of transformational currency and an opportunity to kind of attune to our collaborative potential. You know, and like you've both been saying, it's not easy. It's like an infinitely nuanced practice. That's the thing. Like you can lay out the principles as you get both have done so beautifully, but the real, in a sense, for me, the real joy and fulfillment is in the practice of those because it's an ongoing, infinitely deep art. And I feel very committed to this as a leader. So yeah, I feel like this has been a really exceptional kind of tour de force around the potential for leadership here. So thank you, both of you.
Thank
Thank you.
you, Joel. Yeah, your questions were amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh yeah, actually I forgot, I nearly forgot, but yeah, tell us the title of the book and where can we find out about your work collectively, individually? Yeah.
Well, the book's called The Wise Leader. I can't remember what the subtitle is. The Wise Leader, a practical guide for thinking differently about leadership. Susie's company is Raw People and mine is Leading Systemically, so you can find out about our different companies on the, and then on the Leading Systemically website there's various free materials on the wisdom stuff. Yeah, what would you say, Suze? Have I missed anything?
I think the other thing is we are, you know, over the next sort of 12 months, Joel, we are going to write the Wise Leader Field Guide. So, to your point about, we agree, right? This is a really deep art, and it's infinitely, the possibilities are infinite, but it's also challenging. So, we've set ourselves a task to try and capture what this can look like in practice, whether it's for coaches or teams. So, that's the next part of the journey, which we're excited about.
Yeah, even more in practice, because we thought we were being pretty practical when we wrote the book, because it's got all this stuff for leaders and leadership development people. But then we thought, yeah, I think we need even more practical stuff.
It's in the practice of it, really, isn't it? Like that, I can totally relate to that. Why you would need to go further? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well. And I'll see you again next time.